The question that we're going to talk about this evening, I think, is a very interesting one. It's a relevant one, and it's actually something that came up here in the shul about a week ago, and somebody asked me for a perspective on the issue. So, by way of introduction, unfortunately, we have members of the community who are unable to care for themselves and require assistance of an aide, for whatever reason. Many times, as we know, the community come to know these individuals and these aides as being very selfless, giving, kind, generous, wonderful people. And somebody called me with the following shaila. There is a non-Jewish caretaker who is tending to one of the members of our community. He's a wonderful individual. And he assisted this individual to shul on Shabbos morning. And nobody told him that after he brings this individual to shul, what's normally done is he sits outside. That's what often is done in our shul. So he just sat down next to this individual and stayed there for the duration of davening. And there were people who felt very uncomfortable with that there's a non-Jew inside of the shul while we're in the middle of doing the davening and Kriyas HaTorah and everything else. And they wanted to know, is that appropriate? Is there anything wrong? Or perhaps this is something that we shouldn't even pay attention to. Let him do what he wants. Let him sit where he wants. And it happens to be, I always find, whether it's forgetting halacha for a minute, I always find it very strange when we have an aide or a caretaker who we care so much about and we're so grateful to them for giving of themselves for our loved ones that we find them sitting in the hallway on the steps. I always go over to them and say, can I get you a chair? Like, there's no mitzvah for them, even if they're not going to sit in shul. There's no mitzvah that we have to make them feel very uncomfortable. So we can make them comfortable, but the question is, how comfortable should they be made? Do they belong in a shul? Or perhaps that is not the appropriate place for an aide or a caretaker to be. Now, this person argued that, why do we need them? Once they come to shul, and they've wheeled this individual into shul, and now everybody's sitting together, if the individual needs help in the middle of davening, they'll just turn to somebody next to them, and everybody will be happy to help. So that argument, I think, is really not relevant at all. And I actually discussed it with my father the other day, and he said he doesn't think that that's a fair argument to make, because a person doesn't want to feel that they are the bother of somebody else. So while we have a loving community, and while all of us should be willing to turn to the person next to us and ask whether or not they need our help, that individual does not want us to always feel like they are a burden on us. And therefore, my father felt that just for that reason alone, if the individual is going to need to get up in the middle of davening to go use the restroom or to get a sitter or to get a chumash, and instead of asking their caretaker who is designated to help them, they're going to have to turn to somebody else and ask for help, that is a very uncomfortable feeling. And that's not something that we should just ignore. That's something that should be thought about. That is a consideration that should be factored in as well. So what is the issue here? What are the potential issues? And let's think about that. And then Jeffrey added to the story that I thought was a very interesting caveat as well. Say, for example, you have a situation where somebody has been taking care or helping a family for years and years. You see it all the time when there's a housekeeper who's been living in the house for so many years, helping out this family, raising the children, or helping out with so many different aspects of the children's lives. And then it comes to a bar mitzvah, and who has greater nachas than the housekeeper who really helped bring this child? I mean, I hope, that was a joke. I hope the parents have the greatest nachas, but the question is, the housekeeper also wants to come to the bar mitzvah. So you're only going to invite them to the dinner that you make in the social hall? Do you have a right to invite them into the shul when the young man is laning from the Torah, or when you have an ufra for a sheva brachos or whatever it might be? Is it appropriate to have a non-Jew in the shul at the time when we're davening? I think it's an interesting question. I think there are a few angles to think about. But before we get into the specifics of that issue about the shul in particular, I just think it's a good opportunity to talk about something that is related to this, just to frame the conversation. There's a pasuk in Sefer Vayikra, where the Torah says, V'chisimkru memkar la'amisecha. When you are doing some kind of transaction, la'amisecha means with somebody who is your brother, somebody who is your friend, oh, kano miyad amisecha. Either you are buying or you are selling with somebody who is a Jew. Al tonu ish es achiv. The Torah says, do not take advantage. So, if the fair market value for a certain item is X, I don't have a right when I'm doing business with somebody else to charge them way above whatever the fair market value is. If the fair market value goes up universally, or not even universally, but in our community, The fair market value is higher, so then I have a right to go up together with the market value as well. But I cannot, lotonu ish, as achiv means, I cannot take advantage of people. I'm sure there are going to be people who are going to walk into the store. They don't know what they're charging in other stores. All they know is this is the one that's closest to their house. They never really get out to see what's happening in other stores at all. And therefore, I find that I have an opportunity to take advantage of someone because they're not going to catch me. So that's what the Torah says, you're not allowed to do it. In the context of that, Chazal tell us that it's a little bit strange. We know every word in the Torah is measured. So why does the Torah here in the Pasuk say Amisecha twice? It says, if I'm doing a transaction with Amisecha, or I'm doing a buying or a selling with Amisecha. Why does it mention twice about doing business with another Jew? And Chazal tell us the reason why is because we should try, if we're able to prefer the business dealings that we should do it with our neighbors. We should try as much as we can to buy and to sell to another Jew. Now, that does not mean that if I have a store, I have to put a sign on the store, Chalila. You're not allowed to put a sign on the store that says only these people are allowed and those people are not. It's not what it means. Obviously, if I have a store, everybody's welcome to come and buy and sell, and merchandise can go back and forth and transactions that could happen. I can run a store and a business like everybody else. All the Torah says here is that if I have one singular item, for example, I'm selling a house, I'm selling a car, only one person is going to get that. So who should buy it? Who should I try to sell it to? So here the Torah says, if you have an option to sell it either to a Jew or perhaps to a non-Jew, it would be preferable to give it to the Jew and to give them the opportunity to buy and to sell and to do the business and the transaction with me, as opposed to going to a non-Jew. Surprisingly, the halacha is, even if it means that I'm going to lose a little bit of money. So when I'm selling a house, I want to get the best bidder. I want to get the highest bid, the best price. Happens to be the Jew knows the shtick of our community. You know, it's amazing. When I bought my house, I bought it from a non-Jew. There was no shtick whatsoever. I was the first person that came to look at the house. He happened to be friendly with Mike Krangel. And Mike had heard that this person wanted to sell his house. So he said, you know, we have a new rabbi moving into the neighborhood. Maybe you want to come let him walk around. He said, you know, I don't want to show the house to everybody. I'm still living in it. But I'll show it to one person. He showed it to us. He gave us a price. I told him what I could afford. I said, I'm a young man. I just got married. I have some young children. I'm moving into a neighborhood. I'm not used to any of this. I told him what I can afford. He told me what he wants to charge. That was it. It was simple. Wasn't a million back and forth with shtick and finagling. He gave me pictures of the insides of every wall. He gave me all the infrastructure, all the plans, everything. I didn't have to bother with it. So in a certain sense, there's something very pleasurable about that. And unfortunately, many have gained a reputation of not being so smooth and not being so honest. So that's obviously not in our community, maybe in other places, but it's something to remind ourselves of, that when we are having the opportunity to either sell to a Jew or perhaps to sell to a non-Jew, there, when it's a singular item, the Torah says we're supposed to give the preference to a Jew. If the Jew is being difficult and he's negotiating with me and he's a pain in the neck and he's not coming to the table and I don't think he's honest, obviously that doesn't apply. However, the Shulchan Aruch says, even if I'm going to potentially lose a little bit of money, I should be willing to do that, to forego some of the money, in order to benefit another Jew. How do I know such a thing? I know that because the Torah says that we have a mitzvah to give a halva. The Gemara Bava Metzia Daf Ayin Aleph discusses this at great length. What happens when I have money and I see that somebody else needs to borrow some money because they just can't make it through the month? So I have a mitzvah, I'm kesef talva esami, I'm supposed to lend people money, I should give them opportunity. Okay. Now, what happens if a non-Jew wants to borrow money from me? Obviously, I'm allowed to lend to him as well. That's part of the world. That's part of business. There's one difference. When a Jew borrows money from me, I'm not allowed to charge ribis. I'm not allowed to charge interest. When a non-Jew borrows money from me, I can do the same thing that the bank does. And that is, you take a loan from the bank, you charge interest. I don't have to charge a crazy amount of interest, but I'm allowed to be reasonable. The same way that if they got a loan from any other avenue, they would be allowed to charge interest to this person. So too, when I'm lending money to a non-Jew, I'm allowed to charge interest as well. What you see from that is, the Shulchan Aruch writes that if I only have $100 to lend out, and I have somebody in front of me who's willing to pay interest, and another person who's not willing to pay interest because he's a Jew, the Shulchan Aruch says I have to be willing to lend the money to the Jew and forego the ribis, forego the interest that I would have gotten had I lent the money to the non-Jew. So what do you see? You see that when I have an option of either hiring or doing business with a Jew and making less money, or doing business with a non-Jew and making potentially more money, I have to choose the Jewish option, even though it means that I'm going to suffer some kind of minimal loss. Now, it's not clear how much that amount is. How much am I mechuyev to go? Like my father always told us the example. There was a supermarket on the corner, not a supermarket, like a, in Washington Heights, it was a bodega. But it wasn't a Spanish bodega. It was a Jewish family who owned this little bodega, this little shop. So they had certain items when I was growing up. Obviously, they're going to be much more expensive than if you go to Costco. Why is it more expensive? Because just the operating cost to have such a thing, the convenience of the store on the block, is going to be much more expensive than it's going to be in a big warehouse, in a big wholesale store. Obviously, that's the case. So do I have to now say, I'm never allowed to shop in Costco again because Gor Miglad is owned by Jews, so how can I prefer to go to Costco, which is owned by non-Jews, instead of going to Gor Miglad? That's unreasonable because the price differentiation over the course of a year is tremendous, right? Obviously, Gor Miglad is going to cost more because it's a retail store. Costco is going to cost less because it's a wholesale. So again, the Chafetz Chaim writes, we can't give a definitive number. We cannot say exactly how much it is. He says it's very subjective. It depends what we're dealing with, depends what we're talking about. The same way we would say that we're expected to patronize the Jewish store owners and to do business with Jewish friends and anything of that nature, it also says in Shulchan Aruch that we are supposed to try our best to hire Jewish employees. So that's why I wanted to bring this into the discussion here. When we're talking about somebody who has to hire an aide, aside from all the complications of having a non-Jew living in your house, and there are so many complications of having a non-Jew living in your house, smallest of them is, what do you do with your kitchen? And how do you know that anything in your kitchen is able to be used after the non-Jew is roaming around the house and making food all the time? It's not a simple matter at all. But that's one of the issues. Outside of that, you have this ancillary issue, which is, if I have an option to either have somebody who's a Jewish aide or somebody who's a non-Jew, the same way the halacha says I should always try to do business with the Jewish person, so too the halacha is that I should try my best to also employ a Jewish employee if I have the opportunity to do so. And that is also learned from the same Gemara Bava Metzia Daf Ayin Aleph, that I should try my best as much as I can. Fundamentally, the Rambam writes the reason why is because this is also part of the mitzvah of tzedakah. If somebody is out of a job, if somebody is unemployed, and they want a job, so the halacha is, in such a case, that I should try as much as I can to help them get back on their feet. The Rambam tells us in Hilchas Matnas Aniyim that there are 8 different degrees, 8 different levels of giving tzedakah. And the Rambam goes through it. But then he says, Hamachzik biyad Yisrael shemach. If you have a Jew who's collapsing, a Jew who lost his job, a Jew who's trying to put his life back together, v'noseinu matana o halva, and I identify that person, and I give that person a gift, or I give them a loan, or ose imo shutvus, or I do some kind of partnership with that person. I don't need that person's partnership, but I bring them into the business. Or I find him a job in order that he won't have to go begging around and finding people to help him out. I get him a job where he can take care of himself. Such a case, says the Rambam, that is the highest level of tzedakah. I don't need him to be a taker anymore. Now he has a job, he's on his own 2 feet. So by employing somebody who's a Jew, not only do I now have a worker and I took care of the first consideration, but on top of that, the Rambam says, I also have the opportunity to do a tremendous mitzvah of tzedakah, and this is quoted in Shulchan Aruch Yerodeya in Simen Reish Mem Tes, which is all about the laws of tzedakah. The Rambam in Hilchos Matnas Aniyim repeats this again, and the Rambam says that, you might feel uncomfortable having a Jew working in your house, and you're going to have to tell them, go do this, do that. You feel strange bossing them around, telling them what to do. Says the Rambam, no. Who are the people that should be roaming around your house? They should be aniyim v'yesomim, the needy, the people who are disadvantaged, the people who are destitute. It doesn't mean that every yasom is considered to be disadvantaged. Not true. But sometimes you have a yasom who really is just trying to make it. That would be the greatest gift you can give them. I know a family very well, who Baruch Hashem are a family of means, and I'm always amazed when I visit their home, that they have people, they make up jobs that are so unnecessary for every nebuch in the community. Literally every person is streaming in there, and they think they have a very important job. So one of the jobs that I remember seeing was, every morning there's somebody in the community, I tell you, if you would meet this person, you would see what a nebuch this person is. And they go around the community, every morning they have to go early in the morning, so it gives the person a sense of responsibility. I have to wake up early in the morning because I have a job to do. And they are paid a full-time salary to go every single morning to the bagel shop and the coffee shop and pick up danishes and bagels for every member of the family and drop it off at each one's house at 7 o'clock in the morning. And a lot of it doesn't even get eaten. This family does not need somebody to go buy them danishes and muffins every day. But this person feels, I'm providing them breakfast every day. It's such a mechubad, it's such a beautiful way to help someone. And chahena v'chahena, this family has so many people who are on the payroll, I should say, who are doing jobs that are so meaningless to them, but to the person who's doing the job, he feels like a very important person. And that's exactly what the Rambam says. Is there a greater method of tzedakah than doing that, than showing a person that I can actually believe in you, I think you can take a job and a responsibility, and I'll pay you for it? So obviously, when looking for potential help in the house, when looking for an employee, a Jew, as mentioned, is certainly preferred. For numerous reasons, as we know, it's not always realistic. It doesn't always work out that way. Maybe there aren't so many Jews in our community who are looking for this kind of work. Maybe it's not comparable at all, the Jew who's applying for the job and the non-Jew who has years and years of training. Obviously, all of these have to be factored in. So now the question is, if that is not an option and that is not a possibility, and I have a non-Jew, and the non-Jew now wants to come into the shul, so we're back to our shaila. Is the person allowed to come and stay in the shul while we're davening? Or is there something that feels uncomfortable for all of us about having a non-Jew inside of the shul while we're in the middle of engaging in tefillah? So what's interesting is that we look back to the very first Beis HaKnesses, the very first Makom Kadosh. Where is that? The greatest Makom Kadosh is the Beis HaMikdash. And all the laws of Beis HaKnesses are patterned off of the Beis HaMikdash. So the Pasuk says in Sefer Vayikra, Ish ish mi Beis Yisrael min hager bi Yisrael asher yakriv karbanu laHashem. The Gemara Maseches Chulin Daf Yud Gimel says, why does it say ish ish, every person who comes to the Beis HaMikdash and wants to offer a karban has a right to do so? Says the Gemara, we learn from here that it includes a non-Jew. If a non-Jew comes to the Beis HaMikdash and he says, I want to offer a karban because I believe in God, because I love him so much, because I want to show him how much I am committed to the cause, a non-Jew has a right to offer a karban the same way a Jew does. Now, if a non-Jew walks into the Beis HaMikdash and he says, I want to offer a karban to Muhammad, or I want to offer a karban to my Avodah Zarah, obviously we won't allow that. But if he comes in and he says, I believe in the same God you believe in, and I love him so much and I'm on fire. You know, sometimes you meet these evangelical Christians, they're more on fire with God than we are, unfortunately. It's a kitruk. But let's say you have one of those guys and he walks into the Beis HaMikdash and he says, I want to bring a karban, we have a right to accept it, and we should encourage that. So that's source number one. Number two, you find this again, Shlomo HaMelech in Sefer Melachim, after he has the privilege of building a Beis HaMikdash. So the story is very famous that David HaMelech wanted his whole life to build a Beis HaMikdash. After all of his planning and all of his wanting to do so, HaKadosh Baruch Hu comes to David HaMelech and he says, I'm sorry, I would love for you to do this and I understand your noble intentions, but Dam L'Rov Shafachta, unfortunately you were engaged in many, many lives that were lost. You were fighting battles for the Jewish people, and unfortunately, because blood is on your hands, even though it was for good reason, but those are not the hands that should build a Beis HaMikdash. I understand that you were fighting on behalf of the Jewish army, but still, that's not the right person that should build a Beis HaMikdash. Your son Shlomo HaMelech is going to do it. So Shlomo has this tremendous opportunity, he builds a Beis HaMikdash, and then when they finally open the gates, they're having a big opening ceremony, Shlomo HaMelech says he wants to offer a tefillah. So he goes and he offers a very beautiful tefillah. If you look in the Pesukim and Sefer Melachim Aleph, Perek Ches, the Pesukim there tell us, Vayifros kapav hashamayim, that he spreads his hands out into the heavens and he says, Ein kamoch Elokim b'shamayim imal, you're so amazing, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and I hope you're going to accept all of our tefillos and all of our karbanos and all of our avoda and everything. A beautiful tefillah that he offers. In the midst of all that he says, V'gam el anachri asher lo me'amcha Yisrael hu, and when you have a non-Jew, a Gentile who is not a part of this community that I built the Beis HaMikdash for, Ata tishma shamayim achon shivtecha, I ask you, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, to accept his tefillah as well. V'asisa kechala asher yikra elecha hanachri. And I ask you, whatever the nachri, when he comes to the Beis HaMikdash, he's sincere. He's making the trip to Yerushalayim. Accept his tefillah. I ask you to accept his tefillah. Now, I find that fascinating. That on the day that Shlomo HaMelech is inaugurating the Beis HaMikdash, this is what he's worried about. Not just about the Jewish community, that all their tefillah should be answered, but he says, please, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, when a nachri shows up, and he wants to be a sincere servant of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, I want you to accept his tefillah as well. And finally, the most important source is the Navi Yeshaya, where we are told, V'haviyosim el har kodshi v'simachtim b'beis tfilasi. So there, the end of the pasuk is ki beisi beis tfila yikare l'chal ha'amim, that the Beis HaMikdash is a global, it's a universal address for anybody. L'chol ha'amim, anybody who wants to come and daven to HaKadosh Baruch Hu has a right to do that, and the Beis HaMikdash is the perfect place for that. Beis HaMikdash is not only a makom for karbanos, it's a makom tefillah. It's the greatest place to daven. And therefore, we assume that not only, the Navi says, not only is it limited to Jews who want to come daven there, but non-Jews who want to come as well have the opportunity and the right to do so. I remember somebody was speaking here, I can't remember who it was. They were talking about the Six-Day War, and they said that at the time, Jews were so startled that now we're able to go on the Har HaBayis and we're able to see, you know, the parts of the Kotel and different parts of the Old City that were never imaginable for a Jew to be a part of that experience. So I remember, I think this is when it was, when I went to Eretz Yisrael to celebrate the 50th anniversary of the 1967 war, the victory. So one of the people who spoke then said that he remembers at the time that he was there on Har HaBayis. He was one of the soldiers, and he said there were many Jews who were running through the Har HaBayis. They said, "Where's the Kotel? Where's the Kotel? We want to go pray." And he said, No, you don't understand. The greatest place to pray is here. There's the Har HaBayis." So he said all the soldiers who were with him, they weren't religious soldiers. They weren't familiar with the fact that there used to be a Beis HaMikdash there, that the Har HaBayis is more Kadosh than the Kotel. So they were running through the Har HaBayis and saying, "We have to go find the Western Wall. Where are we going to daven?" And he said, No, once you're here, this is the greatest place to daven." So obviously this is a place where everybody's supposed to feel comfortable. And that really should be the answer to our question. How can we have an objection in a Beis HaKnesses to a Nachri, to a Gentile, coming into the shul and staying for the davening, when after all, the Psukim say that in the Beis HaMikdash itself, a Nachri is considered to be welcome. That was a universal place where everybody had a right to take part in it, and everybody had a right to serve HaKadosh Baruch Hu. But here is where things take a little bit of an interesting twist. The Gemara says in Maseches Sota Daf Lamed Ches, in the name of Rabbi Shua ben Levi, that even though we are in Galus and we feel distant from HaKadosh Baruch Hu in some way, writes the Gemara, Afilo Mechitza Shel Barzel, even if you have a iron or a steel barricade or a blockade between yourself and HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Eina Mafsekes Ben Yisrael La'avim Shebashamayim. You can put up walls, you can put up barricades, you can put up steel and iron. The Ribono Shel Olam is always here. Doesn't matter how much you put in the way, the Ribono Shel Olam is always close to us. That's what the Gemara says. Tosfos says, what does that mean on a practical level? What does it mean? The Ribono Shel Olam is here even with a barricade, even with a machitza. So the Tosfos writes both in Maseches Pesachim and Maseches Rosh Hashanah that the Gemara means to teach us that if you have, this is a very relevant question to Corona, because we had many minyanim outside, and at the same time, you had some people who really weren't feeling well and davened in their homes. So you had a lot of people who were able to hear the minyan or all the Kaddish Kedusha Baruch Hu from across the street. Are they able to answer along or not? So what would you say? So Tosfos writes, that's what this Gemara means. That even if I have a mechitza shel barzel, even if I have walls and a house and windows and everything in between myself and the minyan, I'm still able to join along with them, and I'm still able to answer along, and it's not a problem at all. And that's practically what the Gemara means. That if I have a minyan together, obviously the minyan has to be in one space, in one location. But once I have a minyan together, and they are reciting Kaddish, Kedusha, Baruch Hu, Davening, Shemona Esrei, whatever they're doing, and I'm across the street, and I hear what they're saying, even though there are many different things in the way in between myself and the minyan, it would not be a problem at all. That's what Tosfos writes, based on that Gemara. However, the Shulchan Aruch then says, in the name of the Mahari Abuhav, it's one of the earlier Rishonim, so the Shulchan Aruch writes that that all works as long as there's nothing impure in between myself and the minyan. However, writes the Shulchan Aruch, what if you have tinofes? Tinofes means you have some kind of dirt, like a dirty diaper. Or, for that matter, he says, avodah zarah. If I have an avodah zarah between myself and the minyan, then the Beis Yosef writes, I'm not allowed to answer. Now, how does this trickle down to the Shulchan Aruch? So let's see. Shulchan Aruch writes in Siman Nun Hei in Hilchos Tefillah, listen carefully. Hayu asara nashim b'makom echad, if you have a minyan, and everybody's saying Kaddish Kedusha, afilu misha eino omid imam yachalanos, even if I'm across the street, I'm allowed to answer. Why not? What's the problem? There's nothing in the way of a minyan. They're saying Kaddish, they're saying Kedusha, Baruch Hu. Of course I'm allowed to answer along. V'yesh omrim. Now says the Shulchan Aruch, there are those who say, Shetzarech shelo yehe mafsik davar she'eno naki o avodah zarah. There are those who say that the only time you're allowed to answer along with a minyan is if there's nothing in between yourself and the minyan that is contaminating, that's a problem. But what if I have avodah zarah in the way? Or what if I have a davar she'eino naki in the way? Let's say I have a big garbage dump right in between myself and the shul, right in between myself and the minyan. Would that be acceptable? There says the Shulchan Aruch, no. Now what's very heavily debated here about that Shulchan Aruch is the following. 2 points. Point number one that is debated in the Shulchan Aruch is, what did he mean when he says that if there's an avodah zarah in the way, that will be a problem? Half of the Acharonim say he means only if there's an idol in the way, or if there's a church in between myself and the minyan, so then that would be a problem. The other half of the Acharonim say that's not what it means. It means if there's an Ovid Avodah Zarah, if there is a non-Jew who is an Ovid Avodah Zarah in between myself and the minyan, that would be a hefsek, that would be a problem, and I would not be allowed to answer along with them. That's what half of the Acharonim say. On the page there in Shulchan Aruch, it's a big debate exactly what the Beis Yosef means. Does he mean to say that only if there's an actual Avodah Zarah in the way? We all understand that. Or would he say, no, if there's a Gentile who's an Ovid Avodah Zarah, that is also a problem, and that's going to serve as a hefsik, as a barrier between myself and the minyan. That's issue number one. Issue number two is just a stylistic issue. When the Beis Yosef in the Shulchan Aruch says, this is the halacha v'yei shomer, and some say that is different. What does he mean? Does he mean to say X? Does he mean to say Y? You know, sometimes for those who learn halacha, sometimes you look in the Shulchan Aruch and you try to get an answer and you get more confused than when you started, because he has this opinion, that opinion, you're not sure. Am I supposed to do this? Am I supposed to do that? He quotes both opinions. What's the answer? So there are klalim, there are rules of how to figure it out. In this case, in particular, it happens to be, there's a major, major machlokus about exactly what the Shulchan Aruch meant. So again, there are 2 points here that are not clear. Number one, when the Shulchan Aruch says you're able to answer with a minyan, as long as you hear them, it's fine. And then he qualifies it by saying, some say that if there's a problem in the way, you're not able to answer. Does that mean that's arguing on the first statement? Or does it mean it's just qualifying the first statement, and therefore the first statement only applies as long as there's nothing in the way? Question number two on the Shulchan Aruch is, when he makes this whole comment, does he mean an Oved Avodah Zarah? Does he mean if there's a Nachri in the shul, that's a problem? Or does he mean there's Avodah Zarah Mamish, that there's a church in the way, or there's somebody who has an idol in the way, that would be a problem. For those who have never seen an idol, I have to say, I grew up in Washington Heights. You walk up and down the streets there, you see everything. And you see there are people who actually, you know, when we say in the Hadron after we make a siyum, Anu Mashkim Amei Mashkim, we get up early in the morning, Anu Amelim, we work and they work. And then it talks about the Yoshevei Kronos. I'm telling you, growing up in the Heights, I never understood what Yoshevei Kronos meant till I used to walk the streets of the Heights. You see Yoshevei Kronos, people literally sitting on the corners day and night doing absolutely nothing. Nothing. Zero. Playing the silliest games. Nothing. Not even engaging their minds. At least play chess. Do something that's going to engage your mind. Nothing. Mamish Yoshevei Kronos. That's what it is. So some of those Yoshevei Kronos come outside not just with their waste of time, but they come outside with an actual idol. We used to see them all the time. Somebody actually just came back from a day at work. He sent me a picture the other day that somebody at work went on a trip to India, and he brought him home these two little figurines, and he asked me, what should I do with them? I said, you understand that that actually might really be Avodah Zarah. Like in these countries, they actually serve some of these things. So you got to look it up. He looks it up online. He sees, oh my God, they really are. I'm like, well, you really have Avodah Zarah in your house, but that gives you an unbelievable opportunity to be Mevara Avodah Zarah. How often do we have the mitzvah of actually getting rid of an Avodah Zarah and smashing it and destroying it and show how much we don't agree with it? No. Who has ever had the opportunity before? He has had it. So somebody in our community just performed that mitzvah last week. I'm very proud of him. But anyway, this leads to a very interesting shaila. The Minchas Elazar was one of the early Munkacher Rebbes. Minchas Elazar passed away in 1930s, but the Minchas Elazar was born in 1868. His name was Reb Chaim Eliezer Shapiro, one of the great Gedolim in Poland. What was significant about the time that he lived in? So it just so happens to be he was a prolific author, and he wrote beautiful tshuvas, but the first telephone was created, was invented by Alexander Graham Bell, as all of us know, in February of 1876. He was born in 1868. So he was posed with the following shaila, and at the time, this was like a groundbreaking discussion. He had no idea what exactly a phone does. Nobody understood the mechanics of it. So it's just like interesting to hear how he describes it. But he says the following question. You're not going to believe it. He says, Nishalti lahalacha. This is the Minchas Eloza, the Munkacher Rebbe in Poland. He's saying, "Im yesh lanus amen achar birchas chaveru sheshomea ayudei ha-telefon." Can you answer amen to somebody who says a bracha over the phone? Shehu ha-machuna, I'm going to explain to you what a phone is, he says. Shehu ha-machuna, this is a device, sheshomea kol chaveru al-yada, that you're able to hear your friend's voice, gam berichuk harbe parsos. You're not going to believe it. You can be miles away from this other person, and you can hear what they're saying. Isn't that amazing? And he wants to know, are you able to answer amen when you hear somebody reciting a bracha over the phone? Vinishave. And it just so happens, he says, that somebody in our community was unable to make it to a relative's wedding. So they picked up the phone, and they listened into the chuppah. And he said they made a l'chaim, and they made a bar piyagaf and a shahakal, whatever it was. And he wanted to know, is he able to answer the bracha along with whatever was going on at the wedding? And he says that he gets into a whole technical discussion regarding the mechanism of the voice that you hear on the other side of the line, and whether it's the same, it's not the same, but outside of that, he raises the issue for consideration, and he says, look, the Shulchan Aruch says over here that if you have a Nachri, or you have an Ovid Avodah Zarah in the way, that would be a hefsik, that would be a problem between myself and the minion, I wouldn't be able to answer. He says, do you believe that in the 25, 30, 50 miles from myself to the wedding, wherever it is, there's no church? In all those phone lines, there's nothing in the way. There's no Ovid Avodah Zarah. There's no dirty diaper anywhere. There's no garbage dump anywhere along the way between my house and wherever the wedding's taking place, or between my house and the shul. So it's a fascinating discussion at the time. Again, this was a groundbreaking discussion, and it was considered to be very cutting edge. Now, we all take it for granted. You hear a bracha over a Zoom, you make an amen. You answer amen, but it's not so simple. And part of the discussion that he brings up was that part of the issue that we mentioned. So again, the Shulchan Aruch does say over here that this is a very big question. So take for example, you have the Chazan over there, and I'm sitting up here, and the Nachri is sitting right in between myself and the Chazan. That is exactly what is being discussed here in Shulchan Aruch. Is that something that would potentially be an issue? Now again, if the Nachri is sitting in the back of the shul, minding his own business, doing his thing, not in anyone's way, the whole discussion doesn't even get started. What we're talking about here is the off chance that he takes a seat in between himself, in between somebody who's davening in the shul and the chazan. And the question that we need to ask ourselves is that potentially a problem or not? As far as kavod beis hakneses, I don't know. If he's a sincere person, who's respectful, and sitting there like everybody else, so why would that be worse than a beis hamikdash, where we would allow a non-Jew, and his tefillos are encouraged to be offered as well? That's in terms of that. But in terms of the second issue, that again is dependent on how you understand this line in the Shulchan Aruch. On the one hand, does the Shulchan Aruch mean to say that everybody agrees that if you have something that is mafsik between yourself and the minion, that is a problem? And number two, the question is, does the Shulchan Aruch mean to say if it's a Nachri, who's an Ovid Avodah Zarah, or does he mean that this is limited to a problem only of Avodah Zarah Mamish? If you have a church, or you have an actual idol in the way, that would be considered to be the potential problem. So again, there's room to be makel, there's room to allow such a thing. But I just thought it was a very fascinating issue to discuss, to think about, to decipher, and to try to consider some of the options regarding this particular shayla. Yeah.